Om Parvataya Pratipojitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitam Latavarashinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamanusam Tathami Bhagavad Gita Bhagavadvaishini. Aham me vakshayakalaha dhataham vishvato mukaha aksharanam akaraha asmi dvandvaha samasikasya cha aham eva akshayaha kalaha dhata aham Vishwato Mukaha. So continuing on. Aksharanam, of all of the letters, akshara is a letter, okay, so the alphabet, of all of the letters, the aksharas, aham akara, I am the akara. You know, this, I am the letter a. Oftentimes in Sanskrit, you'll hear when somebody's talking about a letter, when you're learning Sanskrit, you'll say, they'll say the akara, the akara, rakara, the chakara. That kara means the letter cha, the letter ka, the letter ta, the letter a. So if I say akara, it means the kara, the letter a. So of all of the letters, asmi, I am the akara, I am the letter a. The letter a, the sound a, actually a, to make it the pure sound, so a. A is considered the primary sound. All you have to do for a is open your mouth and blow out some air. That's it, a. And everything else is a modification of that ah. Say if you say ah, if you have to now move your mouth, you can make ah into e, ah, e. But really the e is being formed by the vocal system, by the whole vocal system changing its shape. And it's the same, so you say ah, e, oo. But all of that is a modification of this pure sound ah. And so Krishna says, of all of the sounds, I am the akara. Even in Sanskrit, you know, when you learn the mutes, the alphabet, the gutturals and the gutturals and the palatals and the labials, these type of letters, they're actually not. You're not able to pronounce them without some sort of a vowel sound. Like if you were to take, that's why it's called a mute. You can't pronounce it by itself. Like if you take the letter ka, and you take the a away, ka ki ku. You take the vowel sound away, it's k or ch. No sound is possible. Right? And so all of these letters are manipulations and modifications of this very pure sound. So for Bhagavan, you can see the letter A is running through everything. Of all of the letters, I'm the akara. Because the akara is the letter A is the foundation of all of the letters. Mm. So, and he says, dvandvaha samasikasya, of the group of samasas, now we're going into the compound, Sanskrit compounds. So of the group of samasas, I am the dvandva. So let me just tell you a little bit about these samasas for all you Sanskrit people. Be learning this eventually. Samasas are when you bring two or more words together in order to make one single unit. Swamiji gives some examples, like, for instance, workload. Workload, what's your workload? What's the load of your work? It's a workload, but now that workload is functioning as one grammatical unit in a sentence. Like I could say, my workload is very heavy this month, right? So workload is the subject of the sentence, you know, like that. And so, but in Sanskrit, this combining of words into a single word is called a compound. And there are rules, many rules, around the proper combining of words to make a compound. And those rules are divided into four major groups. There's four major types of compounds, which means there's four major ways of bringing words together to form a single word that acts as one unit, one grammatical unit in a sentence. And that single word could have 10 words in it. I mean, a compound is two words but becomes one word, and then those two words will unite with another word to become one word, will unite with a pair of words to become one word. So the compound can grow. There's really, as long as you follow the rules, there's no end to it. It could be a whole paragraph. You know, and in fact, some of the pundits and poets, especially poets in India, would take great pleasure and pride in their compounds, you know. Beautiful, beautiful, long, lengthy, flowery compounds that went on and on and on, and that is one grammatical unit in a long sentence. So you can understand translation problems. So of these compounds, just briefly, there's compounds where the first member is primary. It's called avyayibhava. What that means is, like, if I say, what would be an example, such as something like ati gacchati, he's going, or how about avatara, avatarati, he crosses, but he's crossing down. And so the moving down is the main emphasis of the word. That's called an upasarga. There's a preposition, you know, and that's adverbial, that goes along with the word, and that becomes primary for the word. There's other compounds called, like tatpurusha compounds, where the second member is primary. Like if I say, an example would be Raja Purusha, the servant of the king. Like if I say the servant of the king, the servant of the king goes to town to shop. Right? It's the servant that's going, and everything else is built up on top of the servant. So servant becomes primary. Or if I say the red horse, horse is primary, even though it's adjectival, but horse is primary. The horse is running in the race. It's not the red is running in the race. Red is adjectival to horse, so horse is primary. That's another type of compound called tatpurusha, its technical name. A third type is called bahuvrihi, where if I said, what's a good example? Bahuvrihi is where the word, the compound, is actually referring to something else in the sentence. Like another, a lot of names would be a bahuvrihi. What's a good bahuvrihi? Like Janardana, the punisher of the poppies, the punisher of those who commit sin. Janardana, that's a common way of translating it. But Janardana is a name that's going to Krishna. Krishna is the one who is that. And so Janardana is something which is adjectival, which is in relationship to Krishna. That's not the best example, but that's called a bahuvrihi, where the compound itself is not primary, but it's referring to something else in the sentence, bahuvrihi. Krishna doesn't say, I'm any of those. Because in those, one thing is primary and the other things are subordinate. He says, I'm the dvandva compound. And the dvandva compound is the one where everything is equal. Like, for instance, if I were to say a compound that goes like this, Rama, it goes Rama, Lakshana, Shatrughna, and Bharata, the four brothers, Rama and his four brothers. So what if I just list them? Rama, Lakshana, Shatrughna, Bharata. Bharataha becomes the noun in the sentence, becomes one unit in the sentence. But here, everyone is primary. You know, it's Rama and Lakshmana and Shatrughna and Bharata. Everyone is primary. Not one is dependent or necessary or depending upon the other or adjectival to the other. In this sense, all four are moving together as the subject or the object equally. And so here Bhagavan says, I am the Dvandva compound because I am the same in all beings. I am the same self in all beings. There is not one thing in this creation that is primary over the Atma. Right? Everything is equally the self. This is the self, this is the self, this is the self, this is the self, this is the self. This does not depend upon this. This object or this adjective does not depend upon this object to be itself. I am the one self of all beings. And so from that standpoint, everything is equally, absolutely equally related. There is no thing which is less of myself than another thing. That's why the Rudram is so beautiful, because in the Rudram, you go through listing everything. You are Rudra, you are Rudra, this is Rudra, this is Rudra, this is Rudra, this is Rudra. Never does it say, except for this one. This is Rudra, this is Rudra, this is Rudra, this isn't. This is Rudra, this is Rudra, this is Rudra, this isn't. No, there's no such thing. And that's why Rudra, the chanting the Rudra is so sweeping. It's so sweeping because it's a huge dvandva in the sense that there is nothing which is primary. And so here he says, I am in the compounds, I am the dvandva because I am the one self which is every one of these things equally. You know, it's really, you know, that's such a... that's the truth of it. And the recognition of that is so such a beautiful thing, you know. And something like the chanting of Rudram, or even what we're doing here, you know, and this is a little different what we're doing here. But it's that what we're doing here we'll talk about a little bit later, but it's really fostering the relationship with Ishwara, what I'll talk about a little bit right now. We're talking about fostering our relationship with Ishwara by looking at all of those things which are exalted, which are beautiful, which highlight the highest values, which highlight love and compassion and knowledge and scholarship, and the most exalted or beautiful things within any species, within any set, like the most exalted or most beautiful mountain among all mountains, the most beautiful of trees among all trees, the most powerful of the devatas among a particular class of devatas, the most brave of all of the animals, which he says is the simha, the lion, that which is the most brave of all of the animals. So by going through, as Krishna is going through now, what happens in your mind when you're thinking of appreciating everything in the creation of Ishwara as Ishwara? He's going through highlighting all of the things that you can appreciate that won't cause resistance. You know, like what if he says, you know, I am the of all of the animals, I am the hyena. Now that takes some work. Well, I mean, for me it does. Poor hyena. Have you ever seen a hyena? Yeah. Yeah.
It's bad breath.
Yeah. So, anyway, but say if you bring out something which, like the king of the jungle, the lion is always viewed as the king of the jungle and is exalted for the bravery the lion is. Okay, so if you bring out some example that does not cause resistance in your mind, right? It doesn't cause any closure in your mind. In fact, the example is something that causes absorption in your mind, but it's an absorption that goes outward toward Ishwara. See what I mean? Goes outward toward Ishwara. And so then what you're doing is having a certain kind of a savikalpa samadhi, in a way, an absorption into Ishwara, because these exalted these things that are exalted, just open your heart and open your mind rather than cause closure, you know. The closure, the things that cause closure are a sadhana. They become your sadhana. But right now, Arjuna had asked Krishna, how should I think of you in the world? And Krishna answered this by first saying, if you can see me as the self in all beings, that's Rudra. If you can see me as the self of all beings, what means whatever you see me. You know, wherever you look, you see me. If you can see me in that way, then that's what you should do. If your mind isn't quite able to do that, you know, then start here. See me in these ways. In these ways where the things that are so beautiful, the things that are so exalted, the things that are so special, look at those things and think of me. Because every time you do, you're coming into relationship, you know, with the world. You're coming into relationship with the world as Ishvara, rather than with the world as a jiva, in terms of the jiva relationship. It's you in relationship to Ishvara. And so that's what he's doing here. So he says, so if you appreciate that, they're like little upasanas. I am the akara of all of the letters. I am the dwandva of the samasas, of the compounds. He says, and I am the akshayaha kalaha. Now this is two ways of taking this. Kala means time. Akshaya means the time which is akshaya. It never comes to an end. The indestructible time. If you think of the universe itself, the whole samsara, as a flow, like a river, like a flow of time that never comes to an end. I am that indestructible flow of time. Now, another way this can be taken, Shankar takes it in both ways. So then Swamiji comments in both ways also. The akshara is that which is changeless. So you can say, I am the time of time. I am the self. I am the presence to time itself. When we say, like in the Kenu Upanishad, I am the ear of the ear, you can say, I am the changelessness that is the self of time. I am the aksharaha, which is time. Now, say if I say it like this, I am the aksharaha. Means aksharaha means indestructible. It doesn't change or modify in any way. I am that which is the aksharaha of time, which is what we, I think, unfolded the other day in Satdarshana. I am the aksharaha of time. Means I am the truth of time. The truth of time is the present. Right? You never have experienced the past. You've only experienced the present, which you now call the past. And so whether the present, the past, the so-called present, and the future, all of that is only the present. Right? But then, from the standpoint of this moment right now, because of my remembrance, I can say, this happened to me. I had this experience in the past. But even when you're recalling that experience, it's the present, right? Mm-hmm. But now you are the present. That memory is present to you. And so if we say, I am Kalaha and I am Aksharaha, the truth of time is only the present, right? And so you can take this, that I am the self, which is the Aksharaha, the indestructible presence, which is time, which is the truth of time. In fact, there is no time from that standpoint. There's no time that's actually being experienced. But you can say like that. Do you understand? There's no time that is actually being experienced because the only thing you're experiencing is the present. And then if you try to capture the experience of time here, how are you going to capture it in any given moment? Every moment is divisible. Every moments are linear. They take up time. Time passes. It takes up time. Moments are linear. So how are you going to capture the present within time? Because it's always divisible into past and future. So you can't divide. There's no end to the division. As long as something takes up time, then you can divide it. If it doesn't take up time, then it's timeless. And so the truth of time really is the present, which is always here. For the present, there's no past, present, or future. So I am the Aksharaha, which is time. The Akshara, which is time. It's like saying, I'm the clay, which is the pot. Anyway, I am the being. I am the changeless being, which is time. So that's the other way. Otherwise, you can take it as the endless flow of samsara, of change within samsara, within nama-rupa, within names and forms. Then he says, Dhata aham. I am the dhatra, means karmapala dhata. Karma, the one who holds all of the karma, who is responsible for all of the karma palas, all of the fruits of action. Because I am Vishwatomukha. Vishwatomukha means my face, mukha, goes in all directions. There is nothing that I don't see. Because everything is in consciousness, is in my being. The whole infinite creation, there's none of it. There's nothing in the infinite creation. Goodbye. Okay. There's nothing in the infinite creation that is away from me. And that means the whole creation is what Swamiji will call, you know, an expression of infinite knowledge. Why he uses that term, infinite knowledge, is because any experience that you have is knowledge in the sense that it's a cognition. There's more for it. From the standpoint of a jiva, any cognition that you have or any knowledge that you have, there's always more to know infinitely, because anything that you experience in the creation can be viewed from an infinite number of standpoints. Mm. Right? But if there is no limitation, the limitation of a jiva, there's no limitation of being an object, a sentient being within the creation, viewing the creation and everything from a given standpoint, what if you are the whole? See, for you as a jiva, everything that you experience is knowledge, it is a cognition, right? There's nothing that is a way that you experience that is away from your awareness. So that's how to understand knowledge, anything that you cognize. If you're not cognizing anything, then there's nothing there for you to have any type of relationship with. Think of the entire infinite creation, you know, as not having any obstruction. Every single thing and every aspect is in consciousness without any obstruction. And that's the Vishwatomukha. Means everything from all sides is seen. I face in all directions. So just imagine having no limitation, but the creation itself is known from every direction. That's the Vishvatomukham. That's the nature of Ishwara. And that one who sees in all directions is the Karmapaladatta. Means if you view the infinite creation as an infinite expanse, an infinite order of laws, there is nothing that is away from those laws. And so there's a, within time, there's within the creation, there's time, there's cause-effect relationship. And so that cause-effect relationship is taking place in an infinite order, all of which is known to me. So he says, I am the Dhata, means I am the one who holds all of the karmapalas, the results of actions, you know, in my being. Being Vishwatomukham, there is nothing apart from me. Okay, so now it goes.
Mrityu Sarvaharas Chaham Urbhavascha Bhavishyatam Kirtishrirvachamnarinam Smritirmedadritikshama.
He says, Mrityuhu sarva haraha cha aham udbhavaha cha bhavishyatam kirtihi shrihi vak cha narinam smritihi medha drittihi kshama. He's now, instead of these ones we're in now, instead of saying, among these people I am this and among these people I am that, he's going now just talking about his own vibhutis, his own nature. So he says, aham mrityuhu, I am mrityu, I am Lord Mrityu. Mrityu is death. I am Lord Mrityu, who is sarva haraha, the one who destroys, takes away everything. Sarva means everything. Haraha means the one who takes away. One who takes away everything. In Shankara, in his Bhasha, he says, for Mrityu, for the Lord Death, there is, that death is dvividha. Dvividha means it's twofold. One type of taking away everything is to take away, like for instance, all of a person's all of a person's wealth, take away all of their belongings, take away all of their fame, take away all of their accomplishments. To actually strip a person of what they hold dear. There's that type of mrityu. The other one is actually the pranaharaha, to take away the life itself. So mrityu here is more referring to the one who takes away everything, including life itself. So this mrityu, who is sarvaharaha, takes away everything, including mrityu, including death itself. So I am mrityuhu, the one who takes away, removes, takes away everything. And he says, aham udbhavaha cha bhavishyatam. And I am also the udbhavaha. Udbhavaha can mean birth. I am also the birth, but here in the commentary in Swamiji, the udbhavaha is, and I am also the prosperity. I am the punya. I am the good things among those things which are going to happen, bhavishyatam, among the things that are coming into being. I am all of those things that are flourishing, that are bringing happiness, that are bringing pleasure. I am death, all right, but I'm also among the things that are coming. I am the things that bring abhudaya. Abhudaya are all of those pleasures and enjoyments and happy occurrences other than moksha. You have abhudaya. Abhudaya are all the kind of the worldly positive things that, that can come into being. So I am the one who takes away everything, including one's life. I am the sarvaharaha, the one who takes away everything. But I am also of the things that come to be. I am all of those beautiful things that cause so much happiness and well-being. So bhavishyatam, all of those things that will be coming into being. Udbhavaha, I am all of those, the punya, the positive occurrences. And then he says, Nadi Nam, among the feminine, of the nadis, means literally of the women, but here it means of the feminine nouns, of those feminine nouns in the Sanskrit, I am Kirtihi. Swamiji said in his commentary, some of these things are used actually as name for women because they're feminine words, but they're of the feminine words, these are the ones that I am. Kirtihi. Kirti is fame that is born of dharma. They have other words for fame born of adharma. Kirti. Kirtihi is that fame which is born of dharma, that accompanies dharma. Shrihi. Shri is all wealth. Shri is Lakshmi. So all wealth, all well-being in every aspect, a wealth of education, wealth of health, wealth of material goods, wealth of family, wealth of material happiness, just all of the different orders, wherever there is well-being and wealth, that's called Lakshmi. So Lakshmi isn't just wealth in terms of gold or riches. It's the riches that you find in every given walk of life, like riches in terms of your education or riches in terms of your, you know, of your health, for instance. So Lakshmi, you know, Lakshmi is usually there in every home. Mm. You know, the picture of Lakshmi or the, you know, Lakshmi is there to bless every home because she brings all of the kind of the material happiness, the things that a jiva would like to have, you know, in all of the different walks of life. Lakshmi gives that. So that's Shri. Vak means speech, but vak is not going to be nasty speech. Vak is speech. When when we think of Vak in terms of Ishwara, or Vak even into Vak Tapas in terms of your own speech, your speech, they say, should have three qualities. It should be true, whatever you say. You know, don't say one thing and know something else. Don't lie. Let what you say be true. But let it also be not just true, but be hitam, beneficial, helpful. You know, let it be true, but let it be helpful, worth saying. Let it be hitam. Hitam means helpful. Let it be helpful. You know, but don't let it just be helpful or beneficial. Let it also be priyam. Satyam hitam priyam. Priyam means let it be kind. Let it be compassionate. Let what you say be pleasing for another person to hear. If what you're saying to another person is not pleasing for them to hear, then you have to evaluate why are you saying it. And they say, well, you know, if a teacher can say something to the student, if the student accepts that, teacher as their teacher can say something, maybe that is not so pleasing to hear. Or a parent can say something to their child that may be not exactly what the child wants to hear, you know. But it's satyam and it's hitam. And they don't like hearing it. Okay, but if you're not the parent and you're not the teacher, what in the relationship warrants or gives you the license to go beyond those three? And maybe there is, like for instance, maybe an employer-employee relationship. It should be satyam, it should be hitam, and they may not like their evaluation, you know? So there should be a reason. But I'm saying it should be a conscious reason if you're going outside of the confines of satyam, hitam, priyam. Otherwise, very likely, you're spewing off some steam, you know? It may could very possibly just be coming out of a reaction. In which case, you know, it's probably one of the greatest, considered one of the greatest tapas austerities, practices for antakarana shuddhi, is to actually not let that come out of your mouth, you know, but to sit with it, you know, to sit with it and process it yourself, you know. It's not at all about denial or swallowing, you know. It's not denial to not say things. It's not denial to not act out. It's not denial. You know, it's not about not thinking it or not processing it. It is about processing it and being with it. It's just not acting it out. You know, being thoughtful about that. And so here, when we say for Bhagavan, when we say Vak, he says, of all the feminine nouns, I am Vak. You have to include Vak as what he means there, satyam, hitam, priyam. You know, because we're talking about Bhagavan's vibhutis, you know, not all of the swear words and things that are possible. So for vibhutis. Then next one is smriti. Smriti means memory. Memory is just the general term that the things that occur, the things that you study, for instance, and the things that you did yesterday, and just general. That memory, that shakti, the power of memory, is highly valued in India, highly valued. You know, and he puts next to it medha. Smriti is a general memory, the ability to remember. Medha shakti is what we pray for as mumukshus and as scholars. Medha is to be able to study, to learn something, and then to retain what you learn. The ability to study a book, for instance, you know, and to retain it so that you can actually work with what you've learned. That's medha shakti. And so if you have, Swamiji says, if you have medha shakti, you'll have smriti. But if you have smriti, you won't necessarily have medha shakti. You know? So that ability to be with, to study something, and then to have it, to be able to hold it, and then being able to hold it, you can then work with it. That's the medha shakti. So then he says dhritihi. Dhriti means to have strength, to have courage, to be able to go forward with courage is dhriti. Then it's okay.
Right? No.
Then she should be alright. I don't know if Peter will go get her.
She's wet, probably.
Yeah, let Peter go. It's his job today. Kshama is often translated as forgiveness. Let me be forgiving. Swamiji always makes sure to say something more because he doesn't like that word. You know, to forgive is, there's something pejorative about it. Mm. You know, when you, like, I need to forgive you. He would much prefer understanding. You know, I need to understand you, not forgive you as though you're somebody that I can forgive. You know. So instead, what he does with kshama is to say, you know, that ability to be able to accommodate the positive and negative things that happen, to be able to accommodate without yourself becoming ruffled or unhappy, the negative and positive things that happen to you. And people can insult you or criticize you. And this comes in the Gita, you know, the person is insulting or criticizing or disparaging towards you, saying things about you, you know, that would make you normally feel hurt or react or angry or try to retaliate because how could they say such a thing about me, that type of thing.
Yeah.
You know, or it can go deeply into your heart and hurt you so badly. So the ability to to be able to accommodate that without falling into that type of reaction. And also, positively, the ability to accommodate that the positive compliments without your head going, I'm swelling too much, you know. And then he says, of course, but that doesn't mean that when somebody compliments you, you know, that you don't enjoy it. He said, that's going too far. If somebody says something, you know, acknowledges something about you, it gives you a compliment, it's not very normal to not feel happy that somebody's giving you a compliment. You just don't want it to go overboard with it, that's all. So the ability to hold these opposites that come your way, you know, without losing your own shanti. That's how he takes the kshama. So he says, that's interesting, so Krishna says, you know, of these, all these feminine words, these are the feminine words that I am. Okay? These are all feminine gender. Let's do the next one. Brahat Sama Tata Samnam
Gayatri Chandasamaham Gayatri Chandasamaham Masana Marga Shirshoham Masana Marga Shirshoham Ritunam Kusumakaraha Ritunam Kusumakaraha Brahat Sama Tata Samnam Gayatri Chandasam Aham Masanam Margashirshaha Aham Ritunam Kusumakaraha.
He says Tata similarly or and Brahat Sama Samnam. In the Sama Veda, all of the riks, all of the mantras are sung. And so he says, in the Sama Veda, there's four Vedas. Sama is the, like, just like the Rig Veda, except that the way that the riks, the mantras are handled is different. They're sung instead of chanted. So he says, in the Sama Veda, for all of the riks, for all of the mantras, I am the Brahat Sama. The Brahat Sama is a particular Sama that is extolled, but Krishna is extolled. And of all of the different types of Sama, the different ways that these riks, that these mantras are chanted, I am the Brahat Sama. It's just a particular type of Sama. Then he says, of all of the Chandasam, of all of them, the Rig Veda, of all of the mantras, the riks, I am the Gayatri. Now, the Gayatri is also, it's a particular meter that there are many, many mantras that are chanted according to the Gayatri meter. But here the Gayatri is referring to the Gayatri meter, but it's also referring to the Gayatri mantra, which is considered of all of the mantras one of the most sacred of mantras. And when a person, when a boy takes the sacred thread in the Upanayanam, he's given the Gayatri Mantra. And it's said that by the chanting of the Gayatri Mantra, their boy is considered to be somebody who has mastered the Vedas. To be able to chant and understand the Gayatri Mantra, then understanding that mantra, being able to chant that mantra, he as though can chant the entire Veda. So it's Gayatri is really, maybe many of you have heard of it and maybe some can chant it. The Gayatri Mantra is considered the most sacred of the mantras. You know, and it's something that's held in esteem. It's something that's not given out lightly. It's something that should not be chanted improperly. It's something that shouldn't be sung, you know, like put it to a tune, some sort of a tune. It should be something that, you know, just like the Omkara, the Gayatri is something that if you chant it, it should be given to you by somebody who can teach you how to pronounce it properly, and should be held as something very, very sacred, because that's how it's held in the Indian tradition. It's held as something very sacred. So he says, of all of the meters, I am the Gayatri mantra, I am the Gayatri meter, and of the Gayatri, this is from the commentary, and of, from Shankara, and of the Gayatri meters, I am the Gayatri mantra. Right? So. Then, Masa Nam Margashirsha. Of the months, I am the month called Margashirsha. It's actually takes place sometime between the end of November and December, I think is what they say is when it normally takes place. And in this particular month, all of the pujas and the Vedic rituals that are done are given some extra merit. You know, and so during Swamiji tells a story about it during the month of this Margashirsha, the parents used to of all of the children used to make them get up at 4:30 in the morning. They had all of these various rituals and things that had to be done throughout the whole month. It was a long, long month of doing rituals and austerities, because it's a sacred month for that. And this month is considered to be the month of Krishna. So even, I mean, in India, the Margashirsha is viewed as a month, as being Krishna's month. So of all, and Krishna here says, and he's quoted here, this is quoted that Krishna says, Masa Anam Margashirsha Aham. You'll see that written when they're talking about this Margashirsha. Krishna himself says, you know, of all the months, I am the Margashirsha. So it's very important. Then it says, Ritu Nam Kusuma Akaraha, Kusuma Akaraha. Of the seasons, I am spring. Kusuma means flowers. Kusuma Akara means the manifesting of flowers, the appearing of flowers. So that's a name for Kusuma Akaraha, is a name for spring. Mm-hmm. In Sanskrit, the names themselves have meaning. Of course, compounds have meanings. This is a compound. So Kusuma Akaraha is when the flowers manifest. The manifesting of flowers is a name for spring. So among the seasons, I am the Kusumakara. Okay, let's move on. Jyutam chalayatam asmi. Jyutam chalayatam asmi. Tejas tejas vinamaham. Tejas tejas vinamaham. Jayosmi vyavasayosmi. Jayosmi vyavasayosmi. Sattvam sattvavatamaham. Sattvam sattvavatamaham. Jyutam chalayatam asmi. Tejaha tejaswinam aham. Jayaha asmi. Vivasayo vivasayaha asmi. Sattvam sattvavatam aham. He says, Chala means things that deceive or trick. And chalayatam, of all of those things that deceive or trick or cause loss, Swamiji will say, Dutam, dice. I am the dice. Gambling. Dutam is gambling, but it also is dice. And if you remember in the Mahabharata, all of the Pandavas were thrown out of their kingdom because Yudhishthira lost a game of dice to Duryodhana and his group. And because Yudhishthira, the king of the Pandavas, you know, the oldest brother, because he had this weakness of gambling, you know, he was addicted to it, he had a weakness, that he was invited to this game of this dice game, where the person who was playing the dice had loaded the dice, of course. And so Yudhishthira ended up with each game saying, let's play one more time, and he would bet more and more and more and more, until finally he even bet his wife, the wife who was the wife of all of the Pandavas, he even bet her. And that was the last thing to go. Then he had absolutely nothing, you know. And so somehow he was able, through bargaining, he was able to get the wife, Draupadi, back. But all of them got sent to the forest for 12 years, you know, while Duryodhana then ruled the kingdom. So that's what caused that was the beginning of the Mahabharata to war. Because they did go in, they went for 12 years and didn't get found out, didn't get caught, which was part of the deal. And then they were supposed to come back and then regain their kingdom. And when they were able to make it through that 12 years and come back to regain the kingdom, Duryodhana wouldn't give them. And then they said something like, well, just give us just one village. No. Give us just one house. No. Give us one little room. No. Then Duryodhana said something, I wouldn't even give you a speck.
A grain of sand.
A grain of sand. I won't even give you a grain of sand. And so then, you know, there's all kinds of discussion going on and negotiations going on, but they would not move an inch. And so that was the beginning then of the Mahabharata war. So here when Krishna says, because Krishna was involved in all of this, and so when Krishna says, among all of the deceitful things that cause loss, it is Jyutam, the dice, because he's thinking of the Mahabharata war. Then he says, Tejas, Tejaha, Tejaswinamaham, of all of the brilliant people who are brilliant, and all of the things that are brilliant, the Tejas, the things that are shining with Tejas, especially the buddhis, all of those buddhis that have that antakarana shuddhi and that brilliance that are shining with tejas and strength and clarity, the tejas of dharma, the tejas of mental purity. For all of those who have tejas, I am the tejas itself. I am the brilliance itself. For all of those things that are shining with brilliance, I am that brilliance. I am the Satchitananda. I am the very consciousness which is shining brightly in all of those that have tejas. And then he says, Jayaha asmi. I am Jayaha. I am victory. And you have to add here, Jaitranam. Among those who have victory, those who are victorious, I am the victory itself. Then he says, Vyavasayaha asmi. Of clarity, of those who have clarity, determinative thinking, those who are clear, those who have clarity in their thinking, I am the clarity itself. I am the Vyavasaya itself. Then he says, Satvam Satvavatamaham. Of those who are Satva, you know, the Satva, Rajas, and Tamas. Of those who are Satva, means their mind is pure. The mind is something which reflects the fullness of the self, the mind which is dharmic, the mind which has a great degree of shanti. That's a sattvic mind. So for all of those who enjoy a sattvic mind, I am that sattva. I am the sattva of the sattvic mind. The rajas mind is the mind that's a more aggressive, or it's aggressive. Often aggressive, often very active, often kind of domineering, kind of egoic. And the asuric mind is often very, very dull, very, very dull and kind of disinterested, and, you know, likes to eat and watch TV a lot. That's when you're feeling that way, then there's not a lot of tamas there. Tamasic. I'm really tamasic today. You're angry or or competitive, you know, or fiery, that's more rajasic, you know. And the Swamiji says that say the person is a sattvic person or wants to be, then that person says, I'm really a sattvic person. I'm such a sattvic person, you know. And Swamiji says, you're not a sattvic person, you're a rajasic person. Because you're extolling your own sattva, that's rajasic, he says. So a sattvic person is just a simple person. A simple person, not in terms of a stupid person, just a simple person who simply, you know, simply abides and does what is to be done. Sattvic person. So of those who are sattvic, I'm the sattva. All right, we're going to do one more. Then we're going to do this as our quota. Vishinam Vasudevosmi. Vishinam Vasudevosmi. Pandavanam Tananjaya. Pandavanam Tananjaya. Muninam Apyaham Vyasaha. Muninam Apyaham Vyasaha. Kavinam Ushana Kavihi. Kavinam Ushana Kavihi. Rishinam Vasudevaha Asmi. Pandavanam Dhananjayaha. Muninam Api Aham Vyasaha. Kavinam Ushana Kavihi. Krishna says, of the Vrishnis, now he's going back, all of this time he was talking about his Swarupa, Ishvara Swarupa. Now he's coming back as a jiva, as an avatar. He says, of the Vrishis, means of his caste, that's the name of his caste, and they were all sheep herders, of the Vrishis, of this caste, I am Vasudeva. Right? Vasudeva is the name of Krishna. So of the Vrishi, of all of the Vrishi clan, which is a long clan, big, huge clan, I am Vasudeva. I, Ishwara, I, Bhagavan, I, Ishwara, am Vasudeva. This Karyakarana Sangata means this body, mind, sense organs, person. I, Ishwara, the Lord, am among the Rishis, among this clan, Vasudeva, which is Krishna. So Krishna's talking, right? I, Ishwara, am Vasudeva. Because Ishwara is a, Krishna's an avatar. Krishna is Ishwara taking a form to become Vasudeva. So among this, in this Vrishi clan, I, Ishwara, am Vasudeva, am Krishna. Then he says, Pandavanam, of the Pandus, remember the Mahabharata wars, is Duryodhana and his clan, Dhritarashtra, and the Pandavas, which is Arjuna's group. So of the Pandavas, I, Ishwara, am Arjuna. So remember this Krishna-Arjuna Samvada, right? The whole Bhagavad Gita is this dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna. So now Krishna says, speaking as Ishwara, you know, of the Rishis, I am Vasudeva. And of the Pandus, I am Krishna. And so I'm Arjuna. So I'm Krishna among the Vrishis, and I'm Arjuna among the Pandus, the Pandavas. And so this whole dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna is just a vibhuti. It's a divine dialogue, right? Commandeered and planted here by Bhagavan. So then he says, Muninam api aham vyasaha. Of the munis, of the great sages, you know, I am Vyasa. Now Vyasa is, Veda Vyasa is the one who is really credited with editing the Vedas. The Vedas were not always divided into four. Vyasa divided the Vedas into four according to what they did. And so the Rig Veda is all of the mantras. The Sama Veda is all of the mantras, but put just that are used for the Sama in this particular way of singing. The Yajurveda is all the Brahmana, mostly Brahmana section, where they go into great detail about how the rituals are done. The Atharva Veda, The Atharva Veda has all of kind of the magical chants and potions and things like that. So, and all of them have the Upanishads at the end. But Vedavyasa is credited with having made this division of the four Vedas so that they could be handled by the people, passed down by the people, where one family, but each family would be responsible for a given Veda. And their family, they were responsible, each family, I mean, there's four Vedas, so many families would be having their lineage be one Veda. So another person's lineage would have this Veda, another this Veda. And they're responsible for the memorization and the handing down of the, of that Veda. And so then there's some people, so every family is going to be responsible for one Veda, and then some families, there are people that are called Chaturvedis. There are people that have actually memorized, learned, and learned all four Vedas. Each Veda takes 12 years to learn. So that's 48 years. Some people are three Vedas, dwi Vedas, two Vedas. But everybody's family, according to tradition, is responsible for handing on their Veda. You know? Then, so, if... Now how it is, when the young man takes his Upanayanam and learns the Gayatri Mantra, that mantra stands for that Veda. If they can at least do that mantra, that mantra has the same shanti, the same punya as having learned the whole Veda.
Shortcut.
Yeah, like a shortcut. But there's all kinds of those things. If you can't do this, do this. If you can't do this, do this. If you can't do this, do this. You know? That's there. That's definitely there. However, to this day, all of these Vedas are being handed down intact. There's all these Veda Shalas, you know, Veda Shalas where the young boys start when they're 6, 7 years old. You know, and they go through this training. They learn the entire Veda, and then they become pujaris, they become priests. And even at Rishikesh, not at Rishikesh, but in Coimbatore, Swamiji has a Veda Shala there for young boys. They're actually learning the Sama Veda. You know, because the Sama Veda is, there's a little weakening in that lineage. So he's got 10 or 12 boys that, and probably more by this time, but in the one group that I know, who are being traditionally trained in the Sama Veda. And sometimes they'll even, when we're at temple, on some occasions those boys will come and they'll chant some parts of the Sama Veda. And often, when I've been in Coimbatore, whenever Swamiji's come or he's just come back after a period of time, the teacher, Acharya, will bring these boys to Swamiji, and then the boys will chant for Swamiji. And I've been there a couple of times when they've done it. It's just... beautiful. It's so overwhelming to hear them do that Sama. Chanting of this in that Sama is an amazing thing. So Vyasa also is credited with writing the Brahma Sutras. The Brahma Sutras are those sutras, those short aphorisms that they're like a thread that hold the whole Advaita Vedanta together. A sutra is just a very short aphorism. There's several hundred sutras. And so the students, Vedantic students, will memorize all of the sutras. And then each sutra is unfolded by Shankara. He's written the Bhashya. And so Vyasa is considered the sutrakata, the one who has written all of these sutras. And Shankara is called the Bhashyakata. The one, when we say Bhashyakara, I mean all of these are all commentaries. Bhashya means a commentary. But Bhashyakara means Shankara is the one who has written the commentary for the Brahma Sutras written by Vyasa. And so Vyasa is also wrote the Mahabharata. He's considered of all of the sages the greatest of the sages. And then lastly, Kavi Nam Ushana Kavihi, he says, of all of the Kavis, the Kavis are the seers who can see beyond this time. They can see far into the past, they can see far into the future. And so he says, of the Kavis, of all of the Kavis, I am Ushana, the Kavi Ushana. Ushana is considered a great Kavi, but he was the Kavi, the Kavi for the Rishi, the teacher for all of the Asuras. Asuras are like Rakshasas, mm-hmm. you know? And so they had appointed Ushana to be their Kavi. And so he's exalted as one of the great Kavis, and then Swamiji says, the problem with the Asuras, though, have they had Ushana, this greatest of Kavis, and Ushana would tell them so many things, but they would never follow their instructions. They would never do what they were told. But Ushana would tell them. Ushana would give them guidance and tell them what they should do, but the Asuras could never follow him. So.
Too rajasic.
Yeah, too rajasic. Okay, that's all we can do today. We'll finish the tamasic. Next week we'll finish this. Okay. Let's take a minute. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
This is just a little question, but Krishna said that I am all these feminine nouns, and mm-hmm. praise those qualities.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't say anything about the masculine nouns. Do you think there's any reason for that? Or?
Gee. No, I don't think there's
pretty obvious, don't you think?
Well, what praiseworthy group is as much as you guys?
That's an interesting question. I don't think it's... I mean, everything is masculine. You know, there's so much is masculine. But he must know that so much is masculine that he thought, gee, maybe I ought to pick out the feminine nouns among the women, among the feminine. I am all of these things, you know. It's kind of nice. What are the
change?
Things? Yeah, of all of these things, of all of the feminine things, I am these things. You know, it's just highlighting the feminine.
But that wasn't at the expense of the masculine.
No.
It's probably the rest of the next page, you know. The rest of the book is probably about the masculine.
Actually, it is interesting that he did that, isn't it?
Yeah, it caught my attention.
Yeah.
I thought there'd be equal time.
But all of these, Edward, I could just read out hundreds of masculine here. They're all masculine, so maybe you thought. Kirtihi, Shri, Vak, Smritihi, Medha, Dhritihi, Shama.
Well, those are all masculine nouns.
They're all feminine.
Oh.
Those are all feminine.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have an answer for you. Except that I'm quite sure it doesn't have anything to do with leaving out the masculine. I don't think so. Yeah.
Rather, the Gita doesn't get quite into the
like the way the Rudra does, you know, where it goes like I abide in the thief, and I abide in the cheater, and I am the cheater, and so forth.
Oh, it doesn't.
Krishna doesn't say any of it. He goes more to.
It'll say it in, you know, in verses, but maybe where it's dealing with one verse, something like that. But in terms of a list, like this is a list, mm-hmm. you know, verse after verse after verse after verse. You know, I don't think that that's there, certainly not in the same way as it is in Rudra.
Right.
Of course, when we go into, when he's giving the whole Vishwasvarupa to Arjuna, this whole form, that gets pretty gory.
Oh, yeah, when Arjuna says that's enough, I don't want to see yeah. more either.
Yeah. But no, he says it in so many ways, but this is, in this section at least, he has a reason for doing this. In the positive, because he says, first he says, see me as the self in all beings.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
In all beings. But right. if you're unable to do that, then because Arjuna said, how can I do upasana? How can I worship you, seeing you as the whole? You know, well, see me as the self in all beings, and in that way, you do your worship. Or if you're not ready for that yet, mm-hmm. you know, then do like this. Because to be ready for that, really, you know, there takes some sort of knowledge, some vairagya, some depth of understanding, right? So as that depth of understanding comes, then you can see I am the self in all beings. But Rudra sits in that. Not just people. But people, animals, things, objects,
qualities. You
know, qualities, everything.
Yeah, it's easy to see it through this, the positive, so to speak.
That's what I was saying, especially when you're thinking of upasana. You know, like to meditate on Ishvara as some, you know, some words in it, some worms in some dirty soil, you know, is not the same as
looking at the sun.
It's just a different type of meditation. It's different than, yeah, imagining Bhagavan as the sun or as Mount Everest or as those things that are most exalted, that the very thought of them brings a certain absorption, you know, and wonder and awe to your mind. When you start thinking about them, Ishvara is all of the negatives too. That's a different type of contemplation that is also very important and powerful, but it's a different type.
Well, he's the material cause for all objects.
For all things. He's the self of all things, of everything. Mm. There are... Oh, middle closet. Do you see it?
Uh-huh.
That closet is something to be desired. Oops. Something that needs to be straightened out.
I noticed Pandavas wasn't capitalized here, is it?
Where?
Well, just in the translation. So, I mean, usually we've seen
usually
it capitalized.
Usually you see it capitalized.
Yeah, I was just wondering.
Usually see it capitalized. Is it in the translation, or is it in the... Is it in the italics with the...
Yeah, it's in italics.
Oh, that's why. When, though I don't always follow this, but, you know, in Sanskrit they don't have capital letters.
Mm.
And so when you're doing a transliteration where you're using the diacriticals, then often you have to make a decision, you know. There's no capitals used, even for words like Ishvara.
Well, I'm sorry, I meant in the translation of the transliteration.
then you'd usually see it capitalized.
Okay. And I had one other little question. Didn't Vyasa, weren't the 18 Puranas?
Yes, he did the 18 Puranas also.
And I don't know anything about that. Could you speak really quickly about that?
Because I haven't really studied the Puranas. But basically, what the Puranas do is they go into the entire cosmology of the creation, all of the different lokas and levels, and then the whole genealogy of who came from, who, you know, the genealogy of who
lineages.
Was born from lineages and all of that. cosmology and lineages and all of the mythologies that are in, you know, have to do with that. If you want to borrow one, I'll let you take one home and you can look, because they're all, if you look at one table of contents, they're all similar, because all of them are dealing with this, the cosmology and what's actually going on in the creation, all of the different levels of creation and the genealogies. They're very terse.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They're very, very terse, but then there's also stories. A lot of stories in them. Where's mine up there?
Is that what most
they're
of the
all about relationship, huh?
Yeah, relationships and, yeah.
I'm ignorant of them. It seems like a lot of the stories are referenced or just in the culture.
Oh, yeah. But I would say that you can read all the Puranas, but you can read the Mahabharata and Ramayana. And if you do that, you'll get so many stories. Almost all of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's good to read a Purana also. I'd read the Mahabharata and the Ramayana first, because it would give you more substance to be able to handle the Purana.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then the Bhagavatam is the story of Krishna. That's another couple of volumes. I have that too. I guess
but that's not a Purana. Is that a Purana?
No. No, it's a story. It's just another view of Mahabharata, the Ramayana, the Puranas, the Bhagavatam.
Oh.
There's just something else to read. That's the whole story of Krishna. It also has a lot of stories.
So the Bhagavatam is not Krishna Purana? I said it's a form of Krishna Purana.
I haven't heard that.
No? It stands on its own?
It stands on its own.
Uh-huh. I see.
I never heard it put in with the Puranas, but, you know, this isn't my area of...
Yeah,
of expertise at all. So I've read them. I've read some of the Vishnu Purana. I've read some of the Bhagavatam. I've read the Ramayana, the Mahabharata, and loved it.
Is there a difference between Rakshasa and Asuras?
The Rakshasas are much more energetic and aggressive, and the Asuras are much more dull.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so they say. Yeah.
It's like
slothful.
Uh-huh.
So that would be both the
tamas and rajas.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Thanks.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I like reading the stories because it gives you. It's just a different take on what a human being is.
Mm-hmm.
How to view yourself in relationship to others, and even how, just as a samsari, not with knowledge, just how to handle your mind, how to handle your relationships. There's a lot more freedom in the Indian model, you know, a lot more freedom in terms of being a human being, because they don't have any such idea that you are not as a good dharmic human being. You are capable of having the whole gamut of thoughts and emotions, from rage and hatred to sublime love and ecstasy. It's not about whether or not you have those thoughts. It's how to handle them. That's where the Dharma is. How to handle these thoughts and these emotions when terrible things can happen in the world, or you can be so, you know, so hurt or so insulted, or, you know, bad things can happen that can bring out tremendous rage or sorrow or grief or so many things. So in the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, all of these intense things happen that bring about intense reactions, you know, or by people who are the heroine and hero, you know. So you watch how a hero or a hero, and they have heroines also, that's another nice thing. The masculine and feminine, you know, role models.
So where is the violation then? Is it having a really bad emotion, or is it how you handle that?
Yeah, it's how you handle. How do you How do you handle your life? How do you act it out? How do you handle your emotions? You know, it's not about not having them, where there tends to be in the West more of a...
You're a bad person if you have those emotions.
Right, that's how many were brought up that way. And so that's very constricting, guilt-producing.
Do these texts talk about how to deal with thoughts in terms of, like, do you give them free rein and let them go wherever they like, and then it's just the actions, or you also asked to have some control over the thoughts?
You know, fostering, I don't know that they talk about that, so I'm not sure.
What
Joni's asking me, so I'm trying to answer it right now. She's talking about, what do they say about giving free rein to your thoughts, even though you may not act it out? Is it a good idea to give free rein to the thought? Like, for instance, say you have a negative thought. Is it all right to just go ahead and build upon that thought? You know, you're not going to act it out, but you're going to build upon it.
We're even trying to control them all together. I just got an email from somebody who was saying, and I just have to keep total control over my thoughts, and if one little negative thought comes in, I have to just...
No, that's not. That's kind of the Western way, you know. But, you know, there's something to be said, you know, where you're not supposed to have the thought. That's what I mean, the Western way. That thought is not supposed to arise. That's not real. But you know, when you have a negative thought and you build upon it, it's just the same as if you have a desire and you build upon it. What you're doing is strengthening whatever it is that you're thinking about. You know, and so what if you're thinking about your hatred for a particular person and you're building and building and building upon it? Well, you're actually giving a lot of energy, you know, into that. You're creating a force inside of yourself. It's the same with a desire. Say if you have a desire, it starts out as a small thing, but you feed it, you know, and it builds. It builds with energy. Okay, so you have to be careful about that type of thing. On the other hand, when something really... If something really terrible happens, somebody does something terrible to you, and there are terrible things that happen, there can be, it can create an incredible hurt and rage inside, you know, that it's not that you're building up on that rage, but at the same time you have to be able to be with it, which is to hold it and to allow it to be in an environment that will let it wear itself out, which is very different than feeding the hatred with more hatred. It's very different. That's a very different process, and that process is destructive, you know, and you're just creating a monster inside. It's the same. And the mind is very powerful, and there is a relationship between your mind and what you do. You know, and so say you're feeding something, it's just propelling you more toward action. Mm-hmm. So there's two, I'm talking about two different things, and they could be taken to be the same, and they're not the same. Like if you have a terrible reaction to something, somebody's hurt you terribly, you don't want to swallow that, because that's just a kind of emotional bypass, and nothing good comes of that at all. But you don't want to feed it either. You want to be able to allow it to be and be with it in a way that has some space and understanding and compassion, you know, without trying to shut it down. And at the same time, you're not trying to build it up either. You see the difference? I mean, it's a really big difference. It's important.
It's also once you kind of feel the feelings, often they just dissolve. That's the whole point, right? Yeah. They're just hanging out there because they want to be met.
If you're feeling the feelings, means somebody is there holding the feelings and feeling them from the standpoint of compassion and care. In that way, then they will dissipate, you know. But if you're feeling the feelings and fanning the feelings, then that isn't helpful. It's subtle what I'm saying.
It's very subtle.
I don't think my words are doing it quite justice. But they don't seem to be coming out right, so... Sorry.
I think...
Beware.
I think what you're saying is just a lot of feelings to be, and we don't have to act.
You can allow the feelings to be, but you can also process them with love and care and friendship. You know, just like if you had some terrible feelings and you went to a friend, you just needed to talk it out, you know. You needed somebody to hold it. You have to be able to provide that internally, and that's a big help if you can do that, you know. But say you went and talked to a friend about all of these feelings, and the friend started saying, you know, well, I think we really ought to do something about that. And so say if you have that internal one that's fanning that, that's a problem.
Okay.
You know, as opposed to somebody who's mature. You want to evoke the mature side of yourself, not the immature side. You know, the good parent side, the good teacher side, the good therapist side. You know, whatever model holds you in that way. Let's call it a night, okay?